like a Hellcat.
Welcome to the ninth and final installment of my lecture series on John Gardner's On Moral Fiction. Yeah! Big stretch. This was quite a haul. My name is Matthew McGevna, the host of The Ink Drop on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I've been dissecting Gardner's nonfiction book chapter by chapter, and this episode covers the fourth and final chapter of part two of the book. The chapter is titled Art and Insanity. Now, if you're hearing this for the first time, feel free to stop listening and go back to the previous eight episodes. Since Gardner really builds his case up from chapter one all the way to the end, so sometimes you might even hear some references that we make or we hearken back to something that he said earlier in the book. And so if you really want to get the most out of this series, it's probably good to listen to them in order. And I kind of title them in order so that you can organize your subscription. Because I think wishfully. So this chapter is a reaction to a sort of tired, worn-out trope about artists, writers, poets, the idea that they're all insane in some fashion. So Gardner sort of acknowledges that bit. Look, he spends eight chapters positioning writers as noble actors, as guardians of our societies, as the only honest person in town. So why are so many of them crazy? Well, there's a distinction, I think, excuse me, to be made between artists who become unmoored from reality and or from the norms of society, and an artist who just behaves badly, right? So yes, sometimes writers do help other people hide a dead body, Jack. Some writers fail at their impression of William Tell and shoot their wives in the head trying to hit an apple, William S. Burroughs. Some writers stab their wives, Mailer, and get into fistfights with Rip Torn on a movie set, also Mailer. And some of us punch critics in the face at cocktail parties, Hemingway, and we carry on affairs and we're drunk all the time and occasionally we cut off a piece of our ear. Okay, fine. But that's not the same as insanity, right? And Gardner says, art, as we know, is venerated because of its sanity, not its insanity, right? The good sense and energy with which it goes after what is really there and feels significant, at least to the artist. Later on, he talks about that fine line between genius and madness, but he says something interesting also about the writing process that I think a lot of writers listening right now might not along to if they hear me out. The idea that any writer who has this phenomenon of any writer who's attempted to write long form, a novel, a play, something that requires hours at the desk, falls into a sort of dream state. A trance, if you will. Now, that's interesting because it's not just that we fall into the state, but we actually need the state. And this is why if you talk to writers who have children, young children, writing becomes extraordinarily difficult. There's really no way to do it while the children are under your care. You simply must get them away from you. Now, perhaps the editing process or portion, revising, picking up lines in the galleys, maybe that can all be accomplished with, you know, a three-year-old at your feet. But to sit down and build the fictional walls around your story, to build from scratch, to walk out onto an empty canvas of the page and start planting and raising buildings and forming characters out of dust and breathing life into their lungs, that requires the dream state, the trance. And I'll just say it's virtually impossible to do. It's impossible to do when you have to stop to tie shoes or make PB&J sandwiches or wash out bottles and nipples, right? Now, of course, there's a sort of pop culture cliche about women being better at multitasking and time management than men, and maybe some of that is true, but I've spoken to women writers who have backed me up about this, so I think I'm on pretty solid ground. The dream state, that trance to the untrained, perhaps reads like some form of insanity. When your family members or friends you know, look through the window and they see your lips are moving and you're making facial expressions of anger because the character whose spirit you just embodied is angry in that scene, that can be a bit disquieting, I guess, right? That can appear a bit odd to see someone in that trance state. But it is vital, and it's one way that people might be apt to conflate the writing process with some form of schizophrenic madness. But Gardner has spent this entire book arguing that the purpose of the artist and the purpose of the critic who follows after to inspect his work is to show the world what is healthy, what is sane, and also, either by implication or explicit call-out, what is not healthy. Right? So how can writing be the avocation of the insane? It can't. Okay, so there's gallons of ink dedicated to the idea that all writers are crazy, and we have headlines and biographies. You know, a simple Google search will unroll a library of blog posts and Twitter threads from people who get really bent about this trope, that it's, you know, that it's harmful. It gives emotionally vulnerable people a sense that if they seek help, if they try to better manage their mental health issues, it will somehow diminish their creative light. It'll stamp out their genius. I don't really have anything to say about the harm angle, because I think we can sometimes overinflate harm. But suffice to say that it's just not true. It's just not the case. There's a really well-done article about this from someone called Megan Hunt. The piece is titled, It's Time to Retire the Myth of the Tortured Artist, and it appears in a publication called The Link. I'd like to quote from it a bit here on this issue. Megan says here, "Let's put to rest the idea that the link between artistry and mental illness is a causal one. Yes, there are plenty of artists who struggle with their mental health, and creative expression can certainly be a healthy and therapeutic way to cope with hard times, whether caused by mental illness or otherwise." I'm not sure writing fiction is necessarily therapeutic. But that being said, your creativity is not being caused by your pain. Right? Research into human creativity is, for obvious reasons, quite complicated, but current findings suggest that many artists actually thrive when they're able to distance themselves from their somber, serious consciousnesses. In 2015, the Santa Fe Institute Working Group released a comprehensive report entitled How Creativity Works in the Brain. A key finding indicated that creativity is strengthened when artists find themselves in flow. That's that trance I've been talking about, right? A mental state in which one can suspend the conscious evaluation of their output and simply play. In fact, many common symptoms of mental illness, including but not limited to inattention, chronic fatigue, anxiety, and psychosis, can actually keep artists from reaching their full potential. If we can accept that mental illness could prevent a person from being able to get out of bed or make rational decisions, we should be able to accept that it could make it difficult to pick up a paintbrush or a guitar. Your creativity is not being caused by your pain. It can be painful to watch the publicized suicides and overdoses of our favorite artists and wonder whether there was more that could have been done to help them. The belief that emotional anguish is an intrinsic trait of the world's greatest minds allows us to view real-life tragedies in an almost spiritual manner. For these artists, suffering is fate, and there's no sense searching for accountability when it comes to fate. Artists can also exempt themselves from responsibility through the tortured artist trope, especially privileged artists. This insufferable concept offers artists a false choice between the slow, nebulous process of healing and the promise of creative fulfillment, the latter of which is obviously more appealing. Pretty good. Yeah, she goes on to also mention how this trope is complicated by the entrapments of capitalism, too, which adds a sort of monetary incentive layer to mental illness. Investors, theaters, publishers, agents, they might all be invested in seeing an artist continue to produce and believing that their production is a consequence of mental illness, so they're reluctant to intervene and help the artist who might be struggling mentally and emotionally. I'll put a link to that article in the show notes if you want to read further. But for now, let's get back to Gardner. The artist's creative energy pursues something real, affirms some value which ought to be affirmed. Okay, so The damage done by bad art can be felt in a decaying society. We've all witnessed the way in which bad art, disguised as good and sneaking past our gates by lazy critics looking the wrong way, has somehow convinced us to digest the bad art anyway. Now, Gardner calls this poison versus healthy art. And the poison eaters are those who digest bad art, believing it to be good, despite the fact that Gardner has established that bad art supports death and slavery, that nihilistic side, while good art supports life and freedom. Both get there by the same process. And so you can see how how easy it can be to become deceived, to become a poison eater. One particular poison that very often gets digested is the rash of poets comparing themselves to Cassandra, Gardner says. Maybe a phenomenon more prevalent in the 70s. I don't know. It's interesting, though. Cassandra, the myth of Cassandra, is that she was a priestess of Troy, loved by Apollo, and blessed with divine foresight, the ability to see truth in the future. But eventually, Cassandra falls out of love with Apollo, and Apollo, unable to revoke divine abilities, he doesn't have the ability to take back a gift and completely once it's been gifted to a mortal man, is able to amend his gift to her so that she'll still be able to spout true prophecies, but no one will believe her. So now the title of my college literary magazine makes sense finally, Cassandra. And I can only say it's a close relative of the person who says that fiction writers tell the truth by telling lies, sort of a clever twist on what writers are up to. But there's a sort of, you know, self-aggrandizing nature to taking on the role of Cassandra that doesn't quite sit well. It provides too easy an out for writers who are not really spouting true prophecy to continue down the wrong path and just kind of chalk it up to the deafness of his society. Publishing houses can't handle me, man. Right, so it's not quite right. It has little to do with insanity anyway. One thing that does seem to resonate in this conversation between art and insanity is the propensity for artists to engage in obsession. Gardner talks about this a bit, right, in this chapter. That is, the artist sort of picks at and gnaws at something that is of great importance to their life, and their fiction broadens the scale to the extent that it becomes important to all life. And that much is probably obvious, right? The writer thinks that if it's happening on this small level, on this personal level, it must be happening also on a grander level. Gardner says, art begins in a wound, an imperfection, a wound inherent in the nature of life itself, and is an attempt either to learn to live with the wound or to heal it. It is the pain of the wound which impels the artist to do his work, and it is the universality of woundedness in the human condition which makes the work of art significant as medicine or distraction. What we mean by wound in this case, of course, is some wound to personality and self-confidence, something that attacks or threatens the dignity and self-respect of the artist and must be overcome if this personality is to be healthy. The wound may take any number of forms: doubt about one's parentage, fear that one is a fool or a freak, the crippling effect of psychological trauma, or the potentially crippling effect of alienation from the society in which one feels at home. Whether or not any such society really exists outside the fantasy of the artist. As this last example, alienation from one's home society, hints, the artist's vulnerability may be, as artists half a century's insisted, that the artist is better than those around him, hence an annoyance or a threat. He is one who can see in the country of the blind. He pursues truth, whether or not the pursuit is, in a given instance, useful or important. He will not settle for fashionable simplifications. He is forever raising silly objections, carping over small points, denying the obvious, defending the wicked, asking for precision where no precision is required. The notion of the artist as better than other people is irritating, Gardner says. And it would seem the job of the poet, the writer, is to celebrate, or at very least understand people as members of his society, as opposed to, you know, proclaiming himself as some sort of platonic masterman. And look at all you plebs down there scratching around in the dark trying to follow my lead. I'm not picking on him, I swear. I'll admit, I'm no fan of Jonathan Franzen, but I'm not picking on him. But I was reminded him after I read this part of the chapter and his reaction to the corrections being chosen for the Oprah Book Club. You know, where he was all concerned that his book was being admired by dull Midwestern housewives. And you don't have to even look at that. The literary world is full of these sorts. You just need to score an invitation to a cocktail party hosted by The New Yorker or something, or go to a university reading event. There's a strange little cult of these people, almost like Opus Dei, who go around proclaiming everybody's work to be kind of provincial and pedestrian, while their works of genius have yet to be realized. And it's because the world can't handle their particular message of truth. Ugh, right? That condescending artist, right? That artist who thinks that they're sort of better than the people in which they're pretending to speak to. What Gardner's saying here is that artists are very much in the business of seeing, ferreting out the truth. He rejects what is shoddy, what is superficial about the world, and he's not afraid to say it publicly. So a lot of times, this puts her at odds with her society, right? She retreats into the world of her fiction where ideas like justice and fairness and accuracy have a puncher's chance. And then, when the artist wakes up from the trance, the dream state we spoke about, he looks around and sees the platitudes and the lies and the injustices of his world, and he comes out raging like a lunatic, which gets mistaken for insanity. Right? But it's not. It's born from the fullness of his art. The artist has chosen art over life, right, Gardner says, and he has established his norms. And those norms are not necessarily norms that fold neatly into the norms of his world, of the real world, right? This is the artist as prophet connection, and I don't need to tell you how many prophets have been mistaken for madmen in human history, right? It's almost impossible to distinguish between the two most times. It takes a generation, sometimes two generations after we've exiled her or killed him before we sort of scratch our heads and say, you know, that guy was sort of right. I mean, look at the story of Noah's Ark, right? What is that story, Noah's Ark, if not a method by which we warn ourselves? Don't always mistake the local crackpot for a fool. Sometimes the drunk has important things to say. Okay, so the mistake is in conflating an artist's sensitivity to bullshit and his proclivity toward truth as insanity, as self-torture, when it's actually a form of spiritual alienation. And so Gardner says sometimes alienation manifests itself in literature as the hero, writer, protagonist, whatever you want to call him, embarking on a long journey outside of his boundaries. Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness, Joyce in Paris, right? So when an artist leaves his provincial town, his small town, and heads into another place, the writer usually diverges down one of two roads. She either maladjusts to her new surroundings and then produces fiction that's kind of snarky and arrogant and shows its teeth at everyone. Or the artist recognizes the reality of simultaneous existences. That is, the people she knew back home that she can celebrate and the people she knows now in this new city that she can celebrate. Right? Gardner calls it a healthy doubleness of vision. He attributes this to luck. And I suppose if you go about not thinking about how you might react to new environments, then it could seem like luck, like chance. But if you're conscientious enough of a person, you can choose to celebrate. You can choose to possess this healthy doubleness of vision. And that's not luck. That's work. Chaucer was able to do it. Shakespeare, too. I mean, Canterbury Tales is a celebration of the aristocratic life when it encounters the life of the peasantry, right? Art imitates insanity and borrows most of the madman's methods. Yes. So when Joyce is sitting in France, he becomes Stephen Dedalus, wandering around Sandy Mount Strand in Dublin. Right? Melville becomes Ishmael, while his feet are firmly on the earth and not the sea. Right? The writer goes into a trance and emerges a different person or a group of different people for a while so that he can write. And so he borrows schizophrenia for a while. And he may even babble to himself, right, at Finnegan's wake, or make up words like zizzer, zazzer, zuzz, and vermicious canids. So he borrows the subway man's babbling. But this is not insanity. It's not the same thing. No more than it would be insanity for an actor to play another person in a role. Right? At its core, art is still a representation and an imitation. And most writers know how to extract themselves from the trance of schizophrenia in time, you know, to make supper for the kids. Which is another important distinction. One of the pitfalls to all of this borrowed schizophrenia, though, is the novice writer's misguided sense that he has to sound literary. Right? That is, she has to don the clothing of some Elizabethan bard, even though she lives in 21st century Chicago. You get this sometimes with new writers when you run a small when you run a small workshop of young writers, you'll encounter this a lot. And there's these lines that Gardner quotes from a relatively obscure 19th century poet who is enamored of Shakespeare and Poe, and she wrote this poem as an ode to her family clock. And she says, "A friend of my youth, air from its moldering clay, my joyful spirit wings to heaven its way. Oh, mayest thou watch beside my aching head and tell how fast time flits with feathered tread." Now, granted, this poet was only about 15 years old when she wrote that, but that strengthens my argument that this is a common illness among young writers, feeling the need to sound elegant, mayest, right? And then the opposite of that condition is one in which the writers feel the need to eschew anything that smacks of sentimentality, right? The lovers of Hemingway kind of take it to its extreme, but they end up going sentimental anyway, right? Or there are those writers who just go for the sentimental straight away, right? They say sappy things, untrue things, not investigating the world that they've built too deeply because they assume most of the world agrees with their sentiments, their ideas anyway. These are all the byproducts of the writer's, what do we say, necessary process of putting on some sort of skin that isn't their own and entering the dream state in order to write. Is that a fair way to put it? This Gardner says, this refusal of writers to admit or bother to discover who they are, the sacrifice of thought for pious rant, is one of the most noticeable and tiresome faults of contemporary literature, though hardly a fault invented in our time. The Romantic Age produced more Southeys than Keats's, as the American version produced more Lucretia Maria Davidson's than Poe's. It has always been easier to define one's character in terms of these things one is not than to say what one is, and easier still if the things one is not are all straw men, like the Zeboamites invented by the Mormons. This is the new sentimentality, as A.M. Tibbetts calls it. And A.M. Tibbetts says, the new sentimentality in fiction is characterized mainly by the emotionalism of intellectualized self-pity, dislike, or even of hatred. The new sentimentalist customarily disapproves of his world. The more civilized and decent it is, the more he disapproves of it. He finds refuge in the pedantic play of his mind over the flaws in the world and in himself, for ultimately he secretly dislikes himself, the unhappy outsider, as much as he loathes the bulk of men who live on the inside. He considers insiders beneath his contempt, yet he writes long books oozing with contempt for them, that unthinking crowd of human beings who are stupid enough to ignore him and sometimes even to be happy. Now, this is interesting because this was penned before the craze of memoirs in the 1990s. And I just want to revisit that line about intellectualized self-pity. Part of what made Angela's Ashes such a tour de force in the memoir genre was that it did not smack of self-pity. There wasn't really... He replaces that self-pity with a great deal of humor. Nor did Catherine Harrison's The Kiss or Kaylee Jones's Lies My Mother Never Told Me. There are a whole graduate-level writing courses dedicated to memoir writing, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. I've never attempted to write one, and I probably never will. But I've been around enough people who've written successful, beautiful memoirs to know that they often will warn students against this particular trap that seems to particularly ensnare the memoir writer, that intellectualized self-pity. What a great way to put it. What a great way to put it. Mm. And literary fiction can also fall into this. We're supposed to go along for the 300-page ride of a literary novel because we feel bad for the character And by extension, we imagine the character is some sort of effigy of the writer. It's just, it's a weak foundation from which to build a piece of art. Now, doesn't that contradict then what was said earlier in the book, that the writer's work begins with a wound? Not necessarily. And Gardner points to Anne Sexton's best work, right, as evidence of a writer whose poetry is struggling to affirm life, not death, despite the fact that she struggled to the death with mental illness, right? Her gift, which is every writer's gift, for donning the clothes of another persona, allowed Sexton to survive for as long as she did. So the writer still begins with the wound, but the work they create from that wound is not self-pitying, and it doesn't affirm the value of death. It affirms life. And this isn't true of all of Anne Sexton's poems. So some of them are just dripping with self-pity and melancholy, and they're weaker poems, right, for doing that. But her best work, the work that survives, her most beautiful work, is work that comes from that same wound, but strikes at what ought to be, right, in life. So he talks quite a bit about Sexton as well for that reason, right? What must be remembered is that in good poetry and fiction, the writer speaks first to clarify in his own mind what he thinks and feels, and second, to make that clear to somebody else, on the assumption that the reader has sometimes felt or can now be encouraged to feel the same. Right? Interesting, right? Every person who wants desperately to write, or desperately enough at least to go through the enormous inconvenience even bad writing imposes on one's life, and who, when he or she sits down to it, focuses all attention on finding, for its own sake, some new mode, some new bafflement for the defenseless reader, has misunderstood what makes one sit down at the typewriter in the first place. He justifies his existence by showing the world as if it cared that he's a writer. But the style maker knows, even if his critics miss it, that the whole thing is a delusion. He has not answered the voice of the wound. You're nothing, not even a writer. He has merely drowned it out for a moment and unwittingly fed it ammunition. You're worse than nothing, a fraud. On the other hand, of course, the writer who does nothing to achieve a necessary and necessarily personal style, but speaks the banalities and rhythms of others, is in no better shape and stands in even greater danger of tumbling into nonsense. And here again, he's talking there about style over substance, the thing that critics are now calling the wrong attention to. Yes, style and word choice and phrasing is essential, but it's not the primary job of the writer. It's not why he sits down to write, because it doesn't answer the wound, right? It merely dresses it up. Does that make sense? I hope so. Finally, sane speech is speech to someone. Yes. Right? This goes back to the writer who attributes his lack of success to the fact that the world isn't ready for his genius, right? It's hard to imagine that there isn't an audience for everyone somewhere out there, right? There are people listening. And Gardner is talking here about writers who will give up the calling or feel that they need to write badly in order to win over a commercial audience, a large mass audience. And not only is this condescending, it's a useless exercise, right? There's no point in writing badly, right? And it also sets up this false notion that commercial fiction or popular fiction or genre fiction, whatever you want to call it, can't be literary, right? And I'm not sure if these barriers are broken down now. I do hear a lot of that now, more so than I ever did. In my 20s, I encountered this a lot at university. Writers who sort of thumbed their nose at commercial fiction, so that you're either James Joyce or you're James Patterson, right? Not recognizing that you're neither. And you could probably learn something from both. The fool is the man who arrogantly denies the worth and common sense of the people to whom he pretends to speak, Gardner says. We'll leave that there. Suddenly made aware of a dangerous bull standing in a field, a man finds himself full of two emotions, okay, intense fear and anger. The victor of these two emotions determines the man's decision to run or to fight. The decision he makes is the first act of creation in man. It is when our emotions rise to the level of our consciousness and cause action. Artistic creation follows a very similar path. The urgings of passion, Gardner calls it, right? Both present and remembered, meaning passions that the artist currently feels or passions he remembers from events of his past. Provide the poet with his fantasy, right? So the urgings of passion is what provides the poet with his fantasy, the raw material of his fable. Eventually, he's got to choose which emotion rises to the level of consciousness and then follow where it goes, make revisions, reverse those revisions. He says they must also sometimes meet the arbitrary demands of his form, quote-unquote arbitrary demands of his form, rhyme scheme, syllable count. He says arbitrary. I think there's nothing arbitrary about it. It's just sometimes so without explanation. We don't know why a poet should never repeat more than three times, but we know what the poem sounds like when the poet does, and we know that we don't like it, and that's not arbitrary. Those are the rules, buddy. And if you think it's arbitrary, the need to stick within a certain range of iambic syllables, for example, if you think that's an arbitrary rule, try breaking it. It sounds like when your kid hits a C instead of a B flat at the school concert. Right, it feels like putting your shoes on the wrong feet. But the point is taken, right? We get it. The writer takes the raw material of emotional possibilities and forges them through the responsibility of building art through the revisions. And that is not the handprint of a madman. That's the markings of craftsmanship, of sanity. Gardner says, in any event, sort of setting that aside, this idea of arbitrariness, right? In any event, it seems certain that a writer is someone who has developed to a high degree an ability to remember things and to alter them at will. For instance, placing imagined characters in remembered situations, placing remembered characters in imagined situations, and so forth. And it seems to me, in these imaginative moments, the writer is certainly in some sort of trance. Yes, right? Sometimes we linger in that trance. Sometimes the trance follows us after when we've walked away from our typewriters or walked away from our laptops, right? As was the case with Gardner. Here in this chapter, towards the end here, he relates a story where he'd been working for several hours on a novel, and he was home alone. And after he'd finished writing, he was sitting in his house, and he began to hear voices whispering, and they were the voices of his characters. But he could sort of close his eyes and manipulate the voices and change the context. He was sort of still half inside the dream state or the trance of his writing. Now, that's about as close to insanity as you'll probably find without actually tipping over, right? Sanity is remembering the purpose of the game, he says. And that's kind of an interesting way to look at the issue of art and insanity. The writer and the madman use the same methods and the same energy source, right? The ability to escape their present reality into a fictitious one. Now, if the true motivation for these actions are the same, both are feeling some sort of tension in their life, a psychic wound, a therapist might call it, then creating art is the artist's attempt to address that tension, not evade it, right? Not avoid it, which is what the madman will attempt to do. Note the difference? The artist is free, he says. The psychotic, helplessly driven by his fear, is not. Free, meaning that the artist not only utilizes the dream state or the trance, right? He attempts to manipulate it for the purpose of mankind. And he can leave it when he wants to. He can wake up from it. The insane can't do that, although it's also true that sometimes the insane can recover and the artist can sometimes lose his grip on reality. They can switch places if they're not careful, right? Shakespeare knew this, which is why Hamlet is such a tragic figure. Every moment Hamlet spends pretending to be insane, he's one step closer to actual insanity, and we feel that happening in the play, right? Great art is ultimately sane, right? So how is it that the creation of art needs to borrow from the psychotic? So it's probably closer to the truth to say, instead, great writers verge upon the insane and then linger at the edge of that cliff. They obsess over some particular wound or personal anguish, and from that anguish they create a world that isn't there, a dream. They fill it with furniture and family members and mistresses. And like Hamlet, right, the more fully he embraces this fictional world, the more time he spends inside it. The more passionate he becomes about capturing it so that he may invite you, the audience, into it. Right? He digs even deeper, and surrenders to it as if it's real. And he becomes more divorced from his reality to better transmit the world over to you. Does that make sense? So long as he doesn't get caught up in what Gardner calls hollowness, right, which is fussing about the setting or prioritizing style or language for the sake of language. His devotion, what would you call it, his commitment to the dream world that he's created will dictate the impact of the dream on others. So depending on how devoted and committed he becomes to that sort of fictitious world will dictate what impact that dream state has on the people who read his work. So the poet, the writer is not like Cassandra, right, who is doomed to see the truth while other people can't see it. The writer is more like Odysseus, a passionate explorer of completely fabricated worlds, but with every intention of returning home again. At least that's what I got from it. Now, Gardner brings us back in the final page or so of the book to Thor's hammer. We talked about this in episode one. Thor's hammer is not a weapon of destruction. It's one of creation. It's one of maintenance. He beats back the trolls of chaos trying to get inside, and then he also turns and smashes the trolls who've managed to get past him. So that art, fiction, smashes in order to construct. And then add to that, it's shot through with love. And that's one of his final points in the book. Art is shot through with love. It drives the artist forward. It seeks the right way out. If it's insanity at all, it's a divine insanity. It's an inspired insanity, one that seeks to find the good. And by good, I don't mean some high-minded intellectual thought experiment of the good. It seeks to find the kind of good that carves through the corrupt and corroded aspects of the world in which we live. Now, most writers will say that they do that in their work, and most critics will say they praise those who do it in their work, but some writers and some critics lie, although most are probably not actively lying. Most have probably just fallen victim to trends and the trappings of some new current hip pop culture, philosophy, whatever it may be of the age. Now, the job of the rest of us in civilization is to pay attention to it, though, right? To see when that's happening, because the world that artists create, whether good and sound or cracked and compromised, is the world we end up living in. And that's John Gardner's Moral Fiction on Moral Fiction. Oof. That was a long haul. So if you listen to this entire series, I want to thank you for carving out the time to do so. If you'd like to comment about this or reach out to me with some feedback, something maybe you would think about if you're familiar with the book or you read it yourselves, my email is MatthewMcGevna@gmail.com. No name, no spaces, @gmail.com, MatthewMcGevna@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this series, please, please, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. That really helps boost the signal to others who might enjoy it. Feel free to share this with others. The episodes are easily shareable on your iPhone or any other device you used. I'm also going to just drop an Amazon link to Gardner's book in the show notes so you can pick up a copy for yourself. Ordinarily, I prefer to point you in the direction of local bookstores, but this being a national podcast and not knowing which bookstores would even carry it at this point, I think it's probably more convenient to order it online. Most decent libraries will also have it in stock if you want to go that route. Once again, thank you for listening to this episode. Please check back with the Ink Drop for other content. I do interviews with authors. I give my two cents about literary happenings, stories, scandals as they emerge. So there's a range of other topics that I cover on the show. So do subscribe to The Ink Drop on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And I'll be uploading these lectures to YouTube as well, so you can find me there also. Until next time, I'm Matthew McGevner. You're listening to The Ink Drop, and you take care. Like a Hellcat. Oh,